We're talking about pain neuroscience education, or PNE, which can be particularly effective when it comes to treating chronic pain after surgery for pinched nerves in the spine. Jill Nadeau here, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. In the studio with us are Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Hi, ladies.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Good morning, Jill.
Glad to see you. So what questions do you have? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Are you or someone you know coping with chronic pain? What's your approach to managing it? Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. So, actually, Lori, I think it was you who gave us this topic. Thank you, because it's very long and I had to pronounce it. So what exactly is lumbar radiculopathy?
Well, lumbar radiculopathy is one of many pathologic conditions that causes chronic pain. So in the information that I sent to you, there was a research article recently that discussed the use of this pain neuroscience education to decrease patients' pain following lumbar surgery, so or low back surgery, because it's such a common surgery in our country. However, this same education can be applied to people with chronic pain for any reason, fibromyalgia, other post-surgical problems, or people who have, you know, chronic back pain or chronic joint pain from arthritis or some other kind of issue. So in the past, medicine has taken what we've called a biomedical model to discuss pain, and they point to specific tissues or structures in your body that are producing pain. But what's happened over the years is that we've discovered that there are times when we can't find any physical or anatomical reason for the patient's pain, and that has prompted more research into this area. And we have discovered that much of this has to do with the pathways to and from the brain. And so there's a whole body of research that has evolved looking at what we call the biopsychosocial model of pain, which is a more effective way to discuss this. So this pain neuroscience education is a cognitive-based intervention to help patients understand what to expect about the evolution of their pain. So sometimes pain does come from these anatomical structures, and people have surgeries or injections or physical therapy interventions to treat that anatomical piece of it. But sometimes they also need education to understand the usual course of pain, so that this chronic pain cycle does not set in.
So basically, you're having surgery and you're hoping that this surgery is going to fix your chronic pain, but then you get out of surgery and you still are in pain. Is that what you're addressing?
Exactly. We'll take the example of the lumbar disc issue or the lumbar radiculopathy, where maybe you have a disc herniation or you have some degenerative disease in your back that's putting pressure on a nerve root that's causing pain in your back and perhaps down your leg. And other conservative interventions haven't worked and you have this pain. And so they go in and surgically release that area and create room for the nerve so that the nerve can begin to heal. But there is a process of healing that then has to take place. It's not as if when the surgeon removes the pressure on the nerve that immediately your pain is gone, but you have a different kind of pain as it heals. And so teaching people to understand the normal process of healing and what to expect in terms of pain helps them not become a chronic pain patient. There is research that shows that people who had this kind of education, one is an educational session right before the surgery, and They followed them for up to 3 years. And the people who had this instruction or education in the neuroscience of pain had a significant decrease in medical resource use. Even 3 years later.
Right, even pain medication.
Right, pain medication, despite the fact that they still had some pain. They had the same kinds of pain that the control group had, but their use of services, including pain medication, was significantly decreased.
Because they're prepared?
Well, they're prepared. And the other thing we know with patients with chronic pain is your brain changes how you perceive pain. And so this perception is different. It remodels part of your brain. And so what part of this education does is kind of reset the framework of how a patient perceives pain and how their brain kind of responds to pain. So there's a lot of research showing that patients with chronic pain, every stimulus you give them is perceived as pain, whether it's light touch, whether it's stroking, whether it's a muscle stretch. In their brain, all that is perceived as pain. And so as Lori's talking about, to educate them on kind of how we need to remap our brain and how we perceive some of these sensations and feelings will help decrease their chronic pain. And as Lori said, it's used very commonly in patients with low back pain, but it applies across the board to everyone. And I would definitely say people who have a first-time experience with pain, who have never really experienced a major injury or anything like that and have no idea what to expect, those people in particular need this conversation to help them understand that what they're experiencing is relatively normal. Because you can't just say, the minute I relieve this pressure off this nerve root, your pain is going to go away. You have surgical pain, you have postoperative pain, muscles, tendons, ligaments all have to remodel to the load that they're taking on now that's new. And so having that conversation with your patient is really important.
So who do you have that conversation with? Is that your doctor? Is that a physical therapist?
That's an interesting question. So typically some education does happen prior to surgery, but the studies on that have shown that most of that conversation is about the details of the surgery, about the anatomy of the surgery or the biology or medical aspects of it, and not about the pain. And what we would call neuroscience education, understanding the pathways to the brain, understanding what happens, what are the effects of exercise and activity, what are the things that help modulate pain, what do you expect after surgery? I mean, so many times when I see people postoperatively, they are somewhat blindsided by the pain that they have, that you know, they, whatever their expectations were, they were not the same as the physician. So the conversation and education can be done by anybody. The research has shown that a 1 hour pre-surgical consult that happens the week before surgery functions best. So they found that, for example, if you do it the day before, you know, sometimes they'll see the doctor the day before for some last minute things. People are too anxious at that time and they're in too much overload. They can't remember this stuff. And that 2 weeks before, they forget it. So the week before surgery is really the optimal time frame to do that. So it can be done by a physical therapist. It can be done by some other healthcare provider. And then they also suggest that you include some written information to take home with people because, again, in the heat of the moment, you don't remember things or you don't remember what you want to ask or, you know, like me, I can have a conversation with someone and 10 minutes later, I don't remember what I said. So it's nice to have that booklet or some other handout to refresh that. Physicians typically don't have time for that. Usually it's some other staff member who does that.
So it'd be good for someone who's listening who's maybe going into this situation just to ask their physician to say, hey, can someone sit down and explain to me what to expect afterwards?
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. And particularly in regards to pain, you know, and something other than, well, we'll give you some pain medication to help you manage your pain, but understanding the pain and the usual course and what happens if you're too active or too inactive.
Okay. Right. And interestingly, one of the most common denominators for patients who do suffer from chronic pain, one of the most helpful things that they can do is exercise. So increasing circulation and blood flow, whether directly or indirectly to that area, seems to help. And the biggest challenge is finding the right mode. And that's where seeing a physical therapist comes in to help you decide which mode of exercise, whether we're talking cardiovascular or strengthening, is going to be best for my tissues.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
And I was going to say the other benefit of seeing a physical therapist is it helps the patient understand and process what they're feeling as they do it. Because sometimes, you know, someone will say, or, you know, commonly the physician says, go do this, mm-hmm. or they give them a handout of exercises to do, and they might hurt, and the patient isn't sure if they should do them or not. So sometimes they'll keep going, and then their pain gets worse, and then they never want to exercise again. So the guidance of a PT to say, this is okay pain, this is not okay pain, or let's try modifying this just slightly and see if then you can do it without pain. So having that guidance into activity so that it doesn't deter them from further activity if they have pain.
And speaking of pain, we've got Michelle in Pelican Lake who has a question for you. Hello, Michelle.
Oh, hi. I was just asking if you could give me some insight into chronic pelvic pain.
Can you have a more, do you have a more specific question?
Well, my husband has chronic pelvic pain, and it took quite a while to get it diagnosed, but he goes through cycles of where his pain is really bad. And we know, I think some of it, you know, could be induced through stress is what we've been told.
Okay. Has he seen...
And he has done, like, physical therapy in the past. He's done, you know, manual massage they've done with him, biofeedback.
Has he seen a physical therapist who specializes in pelvic pain or just a general physical therapist?
Nope, she was a specialist.
Okay.
Good. Okay. All right. Well, that's the right track.
I mean, it was a really problem. I mean, from just like, you know, like I said, frequent urination, even going to having bowel movements at times.
Yeah.
So he's kind of kept it in check, but it seems like he goes through these flare-ups and...
So did the physical therapist give him strategies to handle the flare-up or how to modify his activities when he has a flare-up?
Yes, she has.
Okay.
You know, gave him some exercises. And
so is there something, Michelle, that he feels, you had mentioned stressed, is there some sort of other common denominator that your husband experiences when he has a flare-up? Because that's another helpful thing to look for if there's a certain movement or activity or prolonged sitting or prolonged this that is a trigger for his chronic pelvic pain. Have you ever been able to sort any of that out?
No, I think, I mean, he has modified even with his job. He's on his feet all day and he lifts heavy parts and trying to find different techniques, I think, and how to lift them, and that also can cause, you know,
sure,
more flare up.
Yep.
So in between his flares, is his pain manageable?
Yeah. Sometimes he'll go, you know, just fine, and then right, he'll get where it's pretty debilitating, where it's, you know, very
right.
painful.
But then he comes back out of it again.
Yeah, it takes a while.
Yeah. Yeah,
so like he usually will. So I don't know, you know, if there's any key points, I guess, that would help.
Well, I guess when in terms of what we're talking about today, it seems as though your husband has done pretty well in the grand scheme of things, and that is he's able to hold down a job. He has times where he has less pain or no pain and still functions. So he hasn't developed this chronic pain syndrome that we talk about where you have this this drive, this neurologic drive from your brain that interprets normal movements as painful. So it seems as though from this perspective, he's managing it pretty well. And it sounds like there are certain things that flare it. And I guess the key would be to figure out if there are triggers, if there's any cycle, if there's any pattern to it, and then dealing with that would be the next step. And don't feel free to go back to your physical therapist again, because as time changes
right.
and he changes and he has more experience and more information with this, there might be other strategies that they employ.
Right. There may be some exercises that need to be changed or modified. Perhaps he's not being loaded enough appropriately to strengthen from some of his exercises. Therefore, he's not, you know, getting as strong as he could be. So it may be a modification in an exercise or something like that.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that call, Michelle. I wish your husband well. That can't be fun to deal with.
Right.
You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Nigel O'Shea is our technical director today, and Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer. We're talking with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum today. Do you have any questions about physical therapy? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we have all the lines open, so I'm sure everybody's been waiting, but let me give you the number again, 1-800-642-1234. So did you have something to add from...
Yeah,
ahead,
sure.
Mary.
Sure. I was gonna say, you know, one of the important things about having this preoperative visit is to ease some of the patient's anxiety and stress about surgery, particularly, as Jill said, if this is a first time, if they haven't gone through this before and they don't know what to expect. Sometimes they also need validation that they've made the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have heard about, you know, my cousin Judy or my friend's boss Bob, who had, you know, a total knee replacement or had a shoulder rotator cuff surgery or something and had a bad outcome. So sometimes an important piece of this preoperative education is to reassure the person that they've made the right decision. You know, we can outline for them, you've done this, you've tried A, B, and C, you've done all the things you were supposed to do. Your surgeon is very skilled in dealing with this problem, and he or she will rectify it from a tissue perspective. And then, you know, we will deal with the pain. And sometimes just that calming and that reassurance helps decrease pain thresholds.
And those are for elective surgeries. So people who choose to have a lumbar radiculopathy surgery or choose to have a total knee replacement. Then you also have to think about the patients who experience a trauma. So this time of year, we talk about car accidents, motorcycle accidents, things like that. Those people have less time to mentally prepare for any of these elective type surgeries where, you know, you're a patient who chooses to have a total knee replacement and you have time to kind of make your post-operative care plans. You have time to kind of get everything in order versus the patient who, you know, is on a motorcycle and sustains some sort of injury and, you know, has got a job to think about, a family to think about, surgery to think about. And many times, you know, those patients have so many more things to deal with from a psychological perspective. To make sure you're educating them on how this course of care is going to go becomes really important.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. Again, you can join in. We have open lines, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Christy in Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. What's your question?
Well, I'm dealing with a problem that came back from years ago. I had carpal tunnel syndrome, and now I have tendonitis in my left arm and slight form of carpal tunnel. And I pulled out my old physical therapy book with all my exercises, but they're great. I love the pictures and the images from 2003. The physical therapist did a great job. But I have a chiropractor that I'm working with now that has laser therapy. And I just wondered what your thoughts were about that.
So
combining that with the exercises and the ice.
Mm-hmm. So is it hot laser, cold laser? Do you know anything about the laser?
I actually just had one, and it just was a red thing on my arm.
Mm-hmm. And you had to wear glasses with it, like sunglasses?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. So there's different forms of laser out there. There's different classifications of laser. Some are hot lasers. Some are cold lasers. And so without knowing exactly what you had done, it's hard to say. But the theory behind laser is it kind of, for lack of better terms, creates some ion movement and movement of very small molecules within the tendon, which can help break up scar tissue, help with mobility, things like that. I would say as a general rule that in isolation is not going to be very beneficial. Could you add it to your already multifaceted plan of care? And would it help it's probably worth a try. I don't think there's any evidence out there to support or refute it.
Right, right. There's not any research that says you should use this or you should not use this. It's not, there's no evidence for it at this point in time.
But the risks are very low.
Yeah.
For all of those right. classes of lasers.
Right, right. But it, I think the key thing that Jill said is as part of a multifaceted treatment. So that is, you would not just do this, but
correct.
You would need an exercise program. So is the tendonitis in your elbow, in your wrist?
Yes.
Both?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Huh. Your shoulder or just your elbow and wrist?
It's just my elbow and wrist.
Okay. So do you have any idea why it came back?
It's from a combination of typing.
Okay.
Daily for my profession. And then, to be blunt, just shoveling heavy horse manure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you know, have you tried something like a wrist splint?
I do have my wristband on. Yes, okay. I've been wearing that, and that has helped.
Okay. So is it fairly firm when you say wristband? Is it just elastic, or is it a firm
it's
limiting
a
your...
metal piece okay. that's like...
Okay, yep. I know. Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Perfect.
So, you know, there's that, and then there's thinking about your techniques. There's thinking about how you shovel. If you shovel the same way every time, if you could switch hands and change the loading at your wrist and hand so you're not loading it the same way every time.
And also the grip size of
the grip
shovel.
Size of the shovel matters, and icing when you're done, and then your computer, just your setup to make sure that you're in a good position. All those things make a difference.
Yeah, so it's all about load and volume for
right.
her, because Christy's
right.
constantly using this, so it's depending on how we can minimize some of that movement.
Right.
And horses
right.
will continue to poo. So.
Yes, they will.
As long as you feed them.
As long as you feed them. That's right. What goes in must go out. You
exactly.
got it.
And feeding is important.
And then the other thing is, as I say to people in the winter, hire a teenager.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? You know, get somebody to shovel that for you for a while so you can offload this and let it recover. Because throwing a lot of treatment at it, as long as you're still working at that same high workload, it's really hard. I mean, if you think of it like a balance, you know, you're doing these interventions to offset the loading you're doing. But if you're still loading at a high level, it's hard to find enough intervention to win that war.
To get ahead.
You know what I mean?
It's like drinking from a fire hose.
That's a great summer analogy.
Or entering the ocean with a tablespoon.
Oh, there you go. So good luck with that, Christy.
Thank you, Christy. Let's go on to Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Good morning. Got a couple of questions here. One of my knees, my right knee, that's an artificial one. Well, the left one decided it doesn't want to. It doesn't. Maybe it wants to be artificial, too.
Oh, okay.
But I'm going. I had a couple of shots, you know, and a few weeks ago, but I didn't, not the kind where you sing, I froze it, not that kind of shot, you know, it was in my knee, not in my drinking.
Oh!
That was just a joke.
It took him a while, Nancy.
I know.
Yeah, it was slow to
We're
come
a little
in.
Slow, yeah, it took a while for that one to hit the brain.
So I had a couple of those injections there, and, you know, of course, it's bone on, bone in the inside. I said to my physical therapist, I said, why can't they just make a little incision on the inside of the knee there and put a little wedge in there, like if you're going to cut a tree down or something, you put a wedge.
Yeah.
And I thought, that would be a good idea. And
that's a great idea.
And, yeah. And he said, you know what? If they would do that, and it was our idea, he said, we would be millionaires.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I'm with him.
So I don't know. I can get around, but going up and down steps, that's not so good. I go down with the artificial knee, and then I try to make it easier on the bad knee. So.
Well, you know, Nancy, you've done this once before.
Right.
So how did you decide the first time? When was the right time to get it done?
It was worse than the other one is now, you know. The first time it was really bad, and there was nothing. And I was a little bit younger, and so I thought, hey, I'm going to get it done. And You know, my husband had both of his done at the same time.
Oh, I've heard.
2 weeks later, he was climbing the ladders, taking the leaves out of the eave trough.
Oh, geez. But, you didn't tell the surgeon that, did you?
Yes, I did. And he was grinning from ear to shiny ear, you know, but he's holding his hands on his ears. I don't want to hear that.
So,
but anyway, is there any other smart idea to do, or should I just kind of cry
so those are those it? Are those are great questions. So you've already had one done, and now you're a little older, and so concern is, you know, stamina, is age a factor, things like that. So that's something to consider. The other thing you have to consider is that technology is constantly changing, and so total knee replacements are getting better. The longevity or life expectancy of a total knee replacement has improved considerably. The operation time is getting a little bit less. The hospital stay is getting a little bit less. So all those things are to your advantage. So as Lori's general rule of thumb is always when the bad days outweigh the good days, it's probably time to get a total knee replacement or probably time to have that surgery. The thing that I would suggest for you, since you already have a knee that's somewhat compromised because you had a total knee replacement on the other side, and we know that no matter how hard you work, most people do not regain their full strength. I would consider this sooner rather than later, knowing that your other knee is not perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, since this is elective, you can look at your life and say, you know, this would be a good time to have it done. I'd like to have it done then, like in the fall, so I can enjoy the summer, but before it's winter or whatever. Sometimes if you wait too long, then you don't have a choice, and it may not be at a time that's convenient for your lifestyle, you know?
Right.
So anyway, I would say those are the factors you think about.
And discuss those with your physician and see what he or she says about with an in condition, in addition to the status of your knee and your overall function and quality of life.
And the last thing I'd say is you want to be as strong as you can before your surgery, to the point where you almost question why you're having it done. That way your recovery will be better. If you wait until you lose motion in your knee and it's swollen and painful all the time, your recovery is going to be a lot harder. So you don't want to wait too long, and you want to try to stay as strong as you can in the meantime, walking, getting in a pool and walking and moving and things like that, so you stay in really good physical shape.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy, for that question. Let's go on now to Dee Dee in Bayfield. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I was listening, and earlier you had a guy on who was experiencing pelvic floor pain.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, and I recently have experienced the same thing, and I was able to find a physical therapist who actually specialized in pelvic floor pain. And up until then, I went to doctor after doctor. They know nothing about this horrible, debilitating situation. But some of the things that I learned, one was guided meditation for relaxation of the pelvic floor muscle.
Yep.
And that helped me tremendously. Also, there are a couple books that you can get that talk about this condition and how to relax that muscle and what kind of stretches to do. In my case, I found that exercising just made it worse, and I had to rest that muscle for quite a long time before I could start back walking and stretching. And there's creams, there's, you know, this guided meditation for relaxation specifically of that muscle just really saved me from tremendous amounts of pain and disability.
Yep. That's great information, Dee Dee. You know, many people aren't even aware of the muscles of the pelvic floor and how to contract them, how to relax them. Some people don't contract them enough, and so they have leakage and things like that. Some people have too much tone in them and have chronic pain. So that guided imagery and the guidance of a physical therapist who can help make you aware of those muscles and what they do is really useful. Also, the UW Hospital, their integrative medicine department, has videos and information on their webpage about some of the meditation and relaxation exercises that you can do. So if you go to the UW Health site and look at integrative medicine and find their page, you should be able to find some resources there as well.
Okay, thank you very much for those suggestions, Dee Dee. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bill from Madison on the line. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. You can hear me?
We can.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to bring a question into the conversation. Some years ago, probably on Wisconsin Public Radio, I heard a discussion of what was called dancing in the OR. And that was the idea that bringing, well, literally dance and maybe more broadly some sort of ritualization into the process of surgery and medical treatment generally had very positive effect. And I wonder if that's related to what you're talking about.
I think that's more related to the kind of the overall mindset or mood or presence of the medical staff that's performing the surgery. If you talk to surgeons, there's quite a few people who will have some sort of group ritual or some sort of activity they do prior to doing a surgical intervention on a patient, whether it's a moment of quiet meditation, whether it's certain music they like to listen to, whether it's movement, have you suggested, to help the medical staff get their mind best prepared for a good surgical outcome. So what that is different than what we're talking about for the patient. However, it's very important that your medical team obviously is in a very good mental and physical and emotional state when they go ahead and perform your surgery. So I think that's what you're talking about, is the readiness of the OR team on that surgical day.
Right. I think that's really important. I think those are important factors in dealing with the patho-anatomic aspect of the issue that brings you there. What we're talking about is the neuroscience of pain, and that's from the patient perspective. And we would hope that the physician can help facilitate that conversation by referring patients to physical therapy or having other providers in their office provide that neuroscience of pain education prior to and after their surgery. Right now, the research has only been done pre-surgery, where they give them that information beforehand, but they're advocating now to have one session after surgery because, well, now you're experiencing it. Now your pain is probably different because, as Jill said, you have post-operative pain, you have tissue healing, you have inflammation, and helping patients work through that. So, but thanks for that information, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. That puts an interesting picture in your mind of our surgery too, and
yeah,
dancing
exactly.
Beforehand. We're talking about physical therapy and the psychological effects of pain and how to deal with that. If you have any questions, please give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. The address is ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phone, and we have Dawn in Waukesha who has some information for us. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I just, as I'm listening, I just wanted to say there is a place in Waukesha called Katie's Closet with K's, K for the Katie and K for the Closet. And it's part of Team Up with Families. And they have a lot of the medical equipment that's donated. They've got hand braces, leg braces, knee braces, walkers, wheelchairs, knee walkers for your knee surgeries. People, and they're open Wednesdays from 3 to 5 and Saturdays from 10 until 1. And it's all donated and in good shape. So if people are having a need, you might want to have them check out their website or give them a call.
That sounds great. Do they provide that at a reduced cost, or what's the process for people obtaining?
It's free.
It's free.
It's all free.
Oh, that's awesome.
People come in. You have to come. You take your turn in line. You have to come wait in line, fill out a form, and then if we have the equipment, you're welcome to borrow it. Some is on a 3-month loan. Some of it is for as long as you need it, and for example, between wheelchairs, there's a transport wheelchair, which is lighter, mm-hmm. easier to get into the car. You need someone to push mm-hmm. it versus a wheelchair where you could maneuver it yourself.
Got it.
A wheelchair mm-hmm. where you can maneuver it yourself, you can have that as long as you need it. It might be 2-3 years.
Okay. Well, thank you, Don. We appreciate you letting us know. And I'm sure there's a number of places.
Absolutely. Because the copay on durable medical equipment is very, very high. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a great example. Many people don't need it very long term. So, for example, a patient has a total knee replacement. They may need a walker for 6 weeks and then they may be able to donate it. And so something like this is a great strategy. Another place you can go, which is much harder to navigate, is Craigslist. There are many times people will put things on there for a nominal fee.
Sure. Right. Now, do you have to worry about getting something like that that might not be the correct thing you need?
There's always that risk, and I'm not sure who works at Katie's Closet if there's a physical therapist that helps fit things or make sure it's designed correctly. If you're a patient and you're seeing a physical therapist and you have access to something like this, as I would ask my PT, can you send me some pictures or print me some pictures of exactly the device I should be looking for, and then also talk me through how it should fit mm-hmm. To see if something like that is doable.
Yeah, or they can get something and bring it in and have the physical therapist fit it. So canes, crutches, walkers, those things are all adjustable.
Right.
So they can help adjust those for you.
And that's important because if you use it that's not adjusted to you, you can cause more problems.
Correct.
Right?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
She talks from experience. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones here. We've got Juliana in Milwaukee. Hi, Juliana.
Hi, my name is Juliana. I'm 71 years old. I'm in very good shape. And I'm a big believer in PT. I periodically have it just because there's small imbalances in the body that, you know, grow over time. So I had 2 hip replacements a few years ago, and I healed very quickly. 3 weeks ago, I had a lumbar laminectomy with fusion. Mm. I'm healing really, really fast. Mm. So this is my question. I wanted to go to a rehab place where I could have rehab a couple times a day because I can't drive and rest. But they said I was too high level. So, and I know if you're a big sports person, there are special places you can go. But I don't know if you can answer my question, but it just seems like there's a missing middle part in this whole situation where someone like me that, you know, I can walk well without a walker and all that kind of stuff, I can do stuff, but I know I need physical therapy.
And you'd like to be functioning at a higher level. And mm-hmm. from a medical perspective, we want you to be functioning at the highest level you can because it's going to be much more cost effective for us long term and your overall health long term. But you're one of those people that kind of falls through the cracks.
So is your issue just the transportation that you can't drive and you don't have transportation to an outpatient facility?
Well, my PT is quite far from here, so I would need someone to drive me and I could go maybe once a week. You know, if especially in the beginning, I know there's a little things that I'm doing wrong and I'm building more imbalances as I don't correct them right away.
So what about home health?
If
you qualify for home health since you can't drive, have you tried that?
I have not. I haven't had that. I do know some people that have had home health, and I believe that if you have that, you can't leave the house for any reason except religious or medical.
Well, who is going to, they think someone's going to follow you?
I don't know. And I'm not sure of the logistics on that, but I know that the one caveat is that difficulty or issues getting to physical therapy is one of the criteria. So with your inability to drive, and if you can't sit for a prolonged period of time because of this and your PT is fairly far away, I would definitely check into this.
Yeah, I would ask the question.
Right.
And then thereafter, you are, you know, restricted to seeing that PT once a week. You're in Milwaukee, so is that your preferred PT? Because I would expect that there might be a physical therapist closer.
Yeah.
Because in a major metropolitan area.
I've, sleeping with this one for a while.
Sure.
Right. We understand.
Yeah. We understand. Yeah. So I would try the home health, and then thereafter that PT may be able to give you some things to do over the week. You may also be able to do some sort of video visits. I'm not sure what their access is in terms of that kind of a visit, but I know at UW you can do some sort of video visit with a healthcare provider. So that'd be another thing to consider.
Okay. Well, Juliana, hopefully you'll get that taken care of. Appreciate your call. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about physical therapy today. Do you have any questions or a comment that you'd like to give us? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. On the show tomorrow, we talk to the authors of two books, one about the life of being a firefighter and the other about making the decision not to have kids. Hope you can join us. That starts at 11 o'clock on the Ideas Network. But right now, we are talking about physical therapy, and we're going to go straight to the phones. And we do have a couple of lines available to you, 1-800-642-1234. First up, we have Sarah, and she's in Black River Falls. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
What can we help you with?
So I had scoliosis surgery in the early and mid-1980s. So I have Harrington rods placed and fused in my spine, and those have been in place ever since those surgeries. And I've had four children. So as I'm getting closer and closer, I'm about to turn 50, and my back pain is, you know, it's relatively constant, but it seems to kind of cycle almost with my own cycle. There's times that it's not so much and times that it's worse. And I do feel that the older I get, the imbalance in my hips, the height of my hip seems to, you know, kind of compound the pain, and it's starting to affect my gait. I'm just wondering if either of your guests know about any therapists in the state or even in Eastern Minnesota that would specialize in scoliosis patients that have Harrington rods in
place. Well, they're both shaking their heads, Sarah. So
yes. So what, Sarah, what levels are you fused from what to what?
Oh, that's a really good question. I can bend pretty much just at the waist. I don't have any full spinal.
Got it. Okay. So there are physical therapists who are trained in a very specific method called the Schroth method. It's S-C-H-R-O-T-H, Schroth, and it is exclusive for the treatment of scoliosis, regardless of whether you have had surgery or you're managed conservatively. And they look exactly for what you're talking about, these detailed muscle imbalances. And there is a woman in Stevens Point, who is one of the leaders in the United States on the Schroth method and actually teaches courses on it. And I know her name, and she would be a really good person to contact, not necessarily for you to see her, but she may know people in your area that are trained in the Schroth method. So you can either look in your area to see if there are Schroth trained physical therapists, because you're up by Eau Claire, right?
Yep, I'm about 45 miles, outside of there.
Okay, so we can either look if there's somebody in the Eau Claire area that's trained in the Schroth method, or I could give you this woman's contact information in Stevens Point, and she may be able to help you as well. But I would start by Googling Schroth, S-C-H-R-O-T-H, and it's a very manual therapy, biofeedback, neuromuscular training, how to use the correct muscles, treatment that's exclusively for people with scoliosis.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
So if you want that person's contact, just give your contact information to.
Okay. So, I tell you what, we're going to have Nigel put you on hold.
Great.
And Jane will go ahead and pick up that line.
Great.
And get your information. Email probably would be the,
yep,
the best.
And then
thing,
I can,
right,
email you that contact.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Sarah. So that treatment for scoliosis, is that from the time of diagnosis throughout your entire life?
Yes.
Is that?
So, you know, we screen very closely for scoliosis, particularly in females, but can also occur in males at that adolescent age, particularly when they're going through their growth spurt. That is when you can first identify it. Some people are managed conservatively. It depends on the angle of their curve, the severity of their curve. Some people go on to have surgery done, which is the case with Sarah. But one of the things you try and do is try and get as much muscle balance as you can from side to side, so you're not overloading one side, underloading the other side, is what kind of what Sarah's talking about. So the Schroth method is to become a Schroth certified therapist, the first level course, I believe, is 8 days of full time. It's a very intense course. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what Sarah is describing is idiopathic scoliosis, so something that comes on as a teenager really for no known reason. And that's different from an acquired scoliosis that tends to happen in older folks as they develop degenerative disease in their spine and so on, where they'll develop what's called an acquired scoliosis or a secondary scoliosis due to primary back degenerative disease.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to Dave in Iowa. Mysteriously in Iowa somewhere, Dave.
We're from Iowa,
we're
Dave.
From Iowa. We're from Iowa. Yeah, so we're good. You don't have to be shy about where in Iowa you're from.
Northeast.
Where?
Waukon.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
We stayed in Waukon.
We stayed in Waukon. Yeah, yeah. Oh. Yeah, on Ragbri.
Come help me then.
No. Yeah, so what's up, Dave?
I got I think they call it an inguinal hernia.
Inguinal.
Yeah, something like that. Anyways, it's pretty big, about the size of a bratwurst.
Pulling in a little Wisconsin stuff there, aren't you?
Yeah, I am, just for you guys. It's probably an inch and a half, 2 inches. And most of the time, it don't give me any problems. Except when I'm working, lifting heavy stuff, and sometimes it rips a little. But it's not going to strangulate, they tell me.
Okay.
And I'm trying to avoid surgery. Is there some kind of PT I can do? Because I had one before, and it almost killed me.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, I think it would be reasonable to see a physical therapist, maybe someone who specializes in either pelvic pain or low back pain, to talk about exercises or activities to strengthen the muscles in your core without exacerbating the hernia.
Right, and for lifting techniques.
And for lifting techniques and things like that that are not going to make this thing worse. So chances are you've been lifting and moving in a certain way, and they may have some ideas about how to do that differently so that you don't worsen that hernia. So I guess I would say, you know, make a visit, you know, make an appointment with somebody. I like somebody who works in pelvic floor because they work with the muscles in that area more so than other kinds of physical therapists do. And they could give you some strategies. They could tell you whether or not they could help you.
Okay. Thank you, Dave, for that call. And we've got a second Dave, this time in Baraboo. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Hi.
Hi.
I'm an ex-physical therapist.
Oh, nice.
And I kind of wanted to get back to the chronic pain thing and pain. I've had significant surgeries, never had pain afterward, and I hate pain. And I didn't do pain meds. I've never done pain meds. And I know the young woman who lost her leg recently, that shark attack.
Uh-huh.
Roberts did that interview with her, and she said, oh, you must have been in horrific pain. She says, no, I was in shock. But you can't be in shock until the injury. And it's typical with shark bites, people don't have pain, at least not initially at the time of the injury. They feel a tug or whatever, but not pain. And I think, you know, our understanding of pain is inexact. There are not pain nerves as such. And I think people going into surgery, rather than being told, yeah, okay, we'll give you pain meds, it should be, we'll see if you have pain, maybe you won't. Because,
that's a great point.
I think it happens when there's an expectation. Like I said, I've had two or three significant surgeries. Pain was controlled for 2 or 3 days. Went home and never took a pain med and never had pain.
Okay. You know, that's a great point. And I think a part of it is very cultural and anecdotal. What I will tell you is some of the athletes that I've worked with that are not from the United States. We have quite a few international athletes. And their concept and idea of pain management is entirely different than ours. And both of the two that come to mind for me who were German never took anything more than an over-the-counter medication to manage their pain for their post-operative musculoskeletal surgery. They listened to their body, they used ice, they used positioning and strategies like that. And culturally, they both just said, there should really be no reason that I should have to take a high-level pain medicine to get through this. So I agree with you that it is an inexact science, and I'm wondering if part of it is our culture, our expectation that we're going to go from having surgery to the next day running around and doing our job and don't take give ourselves time to recover.
Right, right. Yeah, those are all good points, and thanks for bringing that up, Dave. And you're right, there is this expectation, and that's part of what the neuroscience education is about, is helping people manage their expectations so that they don't end up developing chronic pain or they don't end up addicted to opioids or things like that. So it's a lot of education and suggesting, as you have shown, that you don't necessarily have to have a lot of pain, or you're not aware of the pain, such as the person with the shark bite, because there are other cognitive influences that override that.
And we did have a listener, Shelby, who emailed in wondering what you thought about psychotherapy for pain. How does that work in there?
Oh, it's very, very important. And we don't want to say that somebody's pain is in their head. That's not what we're saying at all.
Right.
But we're teaching them strategies from a psychological perspective on how to manage their pain, how to embrace it, what modifications they can need to do, and how they can actually think about their pain.
Right. So. All important ways of dealing with the pain.
Absolutely.
Did you want to add to that, Lori?
Well, there's a website called retrainpain.org, because Shelby was asking about book suggestions. This is a resource that people can look at with educational programs and things on that. So that was retrainpain.org.
Okay, great. Well, we've been talking with Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody about physical therapy. Do you have any questions? We'll be back to answer those for you right after this look at the news. Jill Lideau here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Our physical therapists are back with us. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. They're here to answer your questions about physical therapy, so give us a call. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, and you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And ladies, before we go to Carl in Johnson Creek, we did have an email earlier from Chris, or actually she had called in, couldn't stay on. We've been talking about different ways to treat pain. She has fibromyalgia and MS, and she said that she wanted to stress the importance of diet. She's on an anti-inflammatory diet, and she also suggests considering CBD oil for pain relief. Is this a good thing? Have you ladies worked with it?
I think staying on a really healthy diet makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of information out there on anti-inflammatory diets and the importance of eating low on the food chain, fruits, vegetables, things like that. So I think that's very important, both because it provides your body with the best nutrients available, and it helps you control your weight. So anytime you have chronic pain, if you tend to be less active, you exercise less, you have pain, and one of the typical strategies for dealing with pain is eating. And so if you're sedentary, you're watching TV, you're seeing ads for pizza and everything else, it's really hard to break out of that cycle of inactivity and overeating. So being very conscientious about your diet is huge. And CBD oil, it's still in its infancy in terms of research. There are places, for example, the community pharmacy here in Madison that is a good resource on different kinds of CBD oil. Apparently, there are different formulations for different kinds of problems, such as primarily inflammation or primarily pain. Although I don't myself have the evidence for that, but anecdotally, I've had people tell me that they have tried different CBD oils, and some are more effective for the kind of problem they're having than others. So it'd be worth investigating and getting information rather than just going and saying, oh, I'm just going to take this. My friend has some, so I'm going to try it. It might not be the right one for you.
Okay. And then just making sure that you make sure it doesn't have any negative side effects or will impact any of the oral medications you're taking. So that's the other thing you need to think about, is just because you're not getting this from a pharmacist doesn't mean that it can't impact any of your prescription medications.
Right. Okay. Well, Carl, thank you so much for holding on. He's in Johnson Creek and he has a question. Hi, Carl.
Yeah. Say, I have been seeing some orthopedic specialists for the last 6 months. I have spinal stenosis. And I almost also in physical therapy right now is trying to strengthen my core muscles. But anyway, the short of it all is that they're talking about spinal fusion of my lower lumbar. And it's kind of scary to think about going into a major surgery like that. So I was just questioning, what should a person do? I mean, and the success, they say, is 70%. But that's kind of my question. I'm kind of concerned about, should I just keep on going? I do have some pain that radiates down my right leg. But I manage to walk, but it's only later in the day when I get a pain in my legs and weakness in my muscles.
Okay. So this is a great question. I mean, this is a perfect question for us. So, Carl, I guess you said you've been going to physical therapy and you kind of mentioned where you are from a functional perspective. Have you been improving? Do you feel like you're getting better with physical therapy and the interventions and all the recommendations your PT has made?
I think I am. Exercising the core muscles and pelvic tilt and those sorts of exercises I've been doing, and I do those every day.
Great.
It was recommended that maybe spinal fusion, and I just can't deal with that.
So Carl, a couple of the questions. First of all, how old are you?
I'm 78.
Okay, and are you pretty active?
Well, I get out and walk and so forth and every day.
All right. And do you know if your stenosis is central canal or foraminal stenosis?
Well, they call it spondylolisthesis.
Okay. That's all right. Spondylolisthesis.
The lower vertebrae is loose.
Yep. Okay. So that makes a bit of a difference in terms of making this decision. So have you had any injections in your back?
Yes, I did. I had 3 epidermals.
And were they helpful?
Well, no, only for a week or so when the pain medication wore off.
Okay. So here's the thing. I would talk to my physical therapist and have them explain the anatomy of the spondylolisthesis. And for the listeners, what happens is you get slippage of one vertebrae forward on another. And as you can imagine, that tethers your spinal cord to some extent, and it decreases the space where your nerve roots are coming out. So one of the reasons they do a fusion is to prevent any further slippage, because if it continues to slip, it can wreak havoc with the nerves, and the nerves can get worse. So I would certainly continue with my physical therapy, and as long as you're making progress, there's no have-tos about this. But if you feel like your symptoms start to worsen, then certainly this would be a reasonable surgery from the anatomical perspective. Your surgeon, I think, has made some good suggestions for you. But unless you're getting bowel or bladder incontinence, if you're tripping with because you're not feeling your feet or ankles, or you're really getting progressive weakness in your legs, that's the time when the decision is actually being made for you. Okay. So those are signs that the load on the spinal cord is too great and you need to do something soon about that. Okay. Does that help? But talk more to your physical therapist who might be able to explain some of these issues to you.
And the other thing is, don't think that all of this physical therapy you're doing now is a waste if you go to have surgery, because as Lori has mentioned, you want to go into surgery in the top condition you can for a better outcome on the other side. So don't think about, oh, I did all this PT and now I'm still having surgery anyway. Your outcome and your recovery process will be so much better because you've done all these things up front. So regardless of which course of care you take, keep doing what you're doing.
Best of luck to you, Carl. We had an email from Cheryl. Her son had a small stroke 11 years ago. He has chronic pain in his shin. His neurologist said there is nothing to do except to take gabapentin for the pain. It bothers him day and night, and he's had a little physical therapy in the early days after the stroke, but then none. And he can work and function, but the pain is draining. Any ideas?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that... For people who live in chronic pain, it is mentally, emotionally exhausting. It doesn't leave, there's no bandwidth left for anything else. And her son has to go to school. He needs to engage with other kids. He needs to socialize. And you just run out of energy for that. So I would certainly explore some of the interventions for chronic pain. And some of this this education in the neuroscience of pain to help him, because he's probably potentially partly because of his small stroke had some changes that are perpetuating this pain. So learning to how to deal with that, either from health psychology would be tremendously helpful for this. Learning behavioral techniques to manage his pain so it isn't so overwhelming. And then there might possibly be some physical interventions. So one of the ways we help manage pain from the neuroscience perspective is with controlled activity. So for anyone who has been in, for example, a sport where you get that sort of runner's high, there are chemicals that are released in the brain that help gate pain. And it's not unlike what Dave talked about earlier when he talked about the shark bite. There are mechanisms and chemicals in your brain that help manage pain. So specific activities to help control his pain, combined with some health psychology to give him other strategies to change his focus.
And the other thing is, it looks like her son had some physical therapy immediately after his stroke, but that was over 10 years ago. So things have changed. His strength may have changed. His mobility may have changed. So in addition to all the things Lori talked about, to see a physical therapist again for an examination to see if there's anything besides the science of pain we can work with, if there's any physical modifications we can do with that as well. So it's been 11 years, and it would be wise to have a checkup, if you will.
Totally makes sense. Thank you for that email, Cheryl. Let's go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy. What can we help you with?
Hello. I am an 87-year-old Caucasian woman. 20 and 19 years ago, I had both of my knees replaced. The left knee had bent inward to an incredible degree before that replacement took place. And actually, it still bends in, but not nearly as far. But my problem now is with my left hip. When I walk, it feels, when I put my hand on my bare skin when I walk, it feels as if the ball is really rubbing in a raspy kind of way in the socket. And I have been recently told that I have advanced from osteopenia into osteoporosis to a very large degree, in fact. And I'm wondering, is it possible that this, when I walk, what it feels like is really that whole joint is going to disintegrate. Is the osteoporosis, or does the osteoporosis proceed to the degree where the bones the bones in the ball and the socket, mostly the socket, just totally disintegrates, so that joint disengages itself?
Oh, that's a good question. Typically, you would have a lot of pain before that process.
Right.
So if you haven't seen your physician to have this hip examined, that would be my next step. It's possible that it's, and I want to say simply, it could be arthritis in your hips. So given that you had significant arthritis in your knees, you still have what I expect is a valgus in your knee that bending inward, so it's placing abnormal loads on your hips. It could be arthritis in your hip, or you could have a small compression fracture on the pelvic side of it as well.
Right.
So
right. And the other thing is, typically if with osteoporosis at the hip, we see more of the fractures and the pathology at the neck. So this could be kind of a referred thing from the neck as well. So
not your neck, the neck of your thigh bone.
The neck of your thigh bone, not your neck by your head. Thank you, Lori. And so it would be worth, as Lori said, seeing a physician because your source of pain could be numerous different things and everything would be managed a little differently. I think it would be good to start with a physician.
Yeah, agreed.
Got a lot going on.
Agreed. Let us know how you do, Nancy.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nancy. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb. What can we help you with today?
Hi. I just saw a physical therapist this morning at my wife's work, and I'm wondering if that's common.
So your wife has a physical therapist at her place of employment?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So can I ask where she works? Is it an industry type of place?
She works for the city of Milwaukee.
Oh, how nice.
Wow.
So there are some organizations, large corporations, or manufacturing facilities that will employ a physical therapist full time. And then the people who work at that facility or for that organization kind of have what we call a closed model, and that's the physical therapist you see, and everything is managed, for lack of better terms, in-house. So the physical therapist is there, close, on site, and can make recommendations, whether it's for somebody who has a desk job, make recommendations for the ergonomic assessment, or if it's a factory, make recommendations for how the manufacturing is done or how you are positioned on the assembly line, things like that. So there is a branch of physical therapy that is much more kind of work or industry related. And so that is one place that physical therapists do work.
Yeah. So if you are on your wife's insurance, and that insurance, as Jill said, is in-house, where they provide their own insurance, then you may have access to all those health services provided there. So it's not the most common way that physical therapy is provided, but it is one of the models out there.
Mm-hmm.
And how was it? Was it good? Was it convenient?
It was phenomenal.
Oh, wonderful.
That's what we like to hear. But yeah, that is one of the models out there, and more and more places are finding it cost effective to have their physical therapist in-house, for lack of better terms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks
for sharing that.
Next we have Randy, and he's in Laval. Hi, Randy.
Hi,
what can we help you with?
Hi. I exercise regularly, and I have a routine where I do, a number of push-ups, a number of pull-ups, and just standard things that are quite helpful. But I've been experiencing in my right lower arm and wrist, after I do these, and I've done them for many years, and I don't believe I'm overstraining it, but then for several hours later, just annoying pain in my hand and wrist. And it's more limiting than what you might think, and distracting, even when I drive then or anything. And so much so that then I'll think, well, maybe I won't do those push-ups or pull-ups, and I don't want to do that. It doesn't swell. It doesn't seem to be broken.
So,
and I'm wondering, what did I do? What should I do?
Right. Is your wrist pain more on your pinky side of your hand or your thumb side of your hand?
Oh. Interesting.
Or neither.
I'm thinking right now. No, it's back right at the wrist, but no, it's actually over towards the pinky. Now that I'm thinking, I was going to say the thumb, but when I bend my wrist, it actually radiates over towards the pinky.
Yeah, I'm wondering if just with all of the weight bearing that you're doing through your hands when you do your push-ups and all of the load you're doing with your pull-ups, you've irritated something called your TFCC, which is a fancy word of saying your triangular fibrocartilaginous complex. It's like saying radiculopathy, right, Jill?
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't have to say
no,
it.
No, there's like a kind of a fat pad placeholder, a whole bunch of ligaments that live there. And when you compress that and then go through a flexion and extension like you do when you do your push-ups, you could have irritated it. Now, why only one side versus the other? If you're right-handed, maybe you're putting more load through your right side, something like that. So next steps would be to probably decrease either the volume or the frequency with which you're doing these closed chain exercises. If you can do the same movement, for example, with a hand weight where your wrist stays in neutral and your wrist isn't moving, but your shoulder is moving, that would be a really good strategy for you. But I'm guessing you've probably irritated your TFCC, which is common in a lot of people that have to do a lot of hand and fine motor skill work.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Randy. Let's go to Reggie next in La Crosse. Hi, Reggie.
Yes, good afternoon. A while ago, you had a woman on from Milwaukee who couldn't drive and had to get to her physical therapy appointments.
Yes.
Here in La Crosse, the Aging and Disability Resource Center offers a copay transportation. Mm-hmm. They have a company called Abby Van.
Oh, sure.
Yep. They must have a contract.
Yes.
And they're up in Neillsville, so they might be all around the state. Anyway, it's every time you take a ride, it's a $3.50 copay.
Yep.
So if you ride to the dentist.
That's wonderful.
Yep, that's great, Reggie. Thank you for pointing out that resource.
And right,
that's available here in Madison as well. If you just go to the ARDC website, if you can get online, or call or ask,
right,
call your provider and ask for the resource from ARDC, and they have a number of different resources available for people.
Right. So thank you for pointing that out. That would be a good resource for our Milwaukee friend.
Yep, exactly.
Definitely. Let's take one more call here. We've got Donna in Menominee Falls waiting. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
What can we help you with?
Well, I'm 85 years old, and I have a trapped nerve in my left buttocks, which runs down into the shin on the front of that leg, and it's getting chronic. I've been doing exercises with a physical therapy who is my granddaughter,
nice.
My granddaughter, but also I've been doing exercises and stretching and heating and ice, and it's just a chronic pain that comes and goes.
All right. So you've been doing things that are directed at your buttocks, basically.
My buttocks, right? Strengthening the other leg,
okay.
The muscles in the other leg are stronger than the left leg.
Sure. What about things directed at your back?
Well, I do a lot of exercises with flat on the back and
okay.
So I have been doing mostly all of the exercises she's recommended.
Okay.
And I do them every day. And I also go to the Y and I'm a walker.
Good for you. So so one of the things is when we have this pain in our buttocks, sometimes it's hard to know where the pain originates. Sometimes it comes from your back, and interventions directed more towards your lower lumbar spine make sense. So that would be another thing to consider in terms of your exercises, is focusing it a little bit elsewhere.
Right. I think that would be a really good strategy as well. And it sounds like you're being very compliant and doing a lot of things right. So maybe we just need to shift this rehab or take a look, in addition to the buttock pain, looking at your back a little bit more. So I'd encourage your granddaughter to do that.
Yeah. And how long has it been going on?
Well, when I was in my 60s, I had trouble with the other side and had physical therapy and ultrasound. And, you know, eventually that went away with no problem. It's still a little sore on and off, but nothing, you know, nothing painful. More when I exercise, I can feel it a little bit there.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, keep at it. And if it doesn't improve, see your physician.
Right. All right. Good luck, Donna. We've been talking with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. They'll be back with us on August 19th. On the show tomorrow, we'll talk to the authors of two different books. The first one is a novel about working as a firefighter and the other about making the decision to be childless. Hope you can join us starting at 11 o'clock.